My dad started east sometime in the 30s with the on to Ottawa man. He'd enough of the camps and the dole and the handouts. He wanted to work and to tie the loose ends. Drifted from factory to foundry to flophouse. The war sorted out what mere men could not. In Sudbury's forges he worked like a madman. Those years lost to hunger, Dad never forgot.
How did Canada take the lead in social programs in the 60s and union dancing in the 70s?
What we learn from history is that when we gain the labor rights and when we gain these advancements in social justice because we're fighting in the workplace and changing politics in that way, that we don't lose sight of what Mother Jones also told us, which was, you will fight and win, fight and lose, but you must fight.
In this week's Labor History Today, Sarah Nelson and Alvin Finkel explore the differences and similarities between the labor movement in the United States and Canada. Sarah Nelson is the president of the Association of Flight Attendants, and Alvin Finkel is the president of the Alberta Labor History Society. They participated in an online forum on March 18th, sponsored by the U.S.-Canadian Labor History Collaborative, which is a new collaboration of organizations dedicated to preserving and promoting labor history. The collaborative was formed last year by representatives of some 20 organizations that focus on preserving and promoting the history of workers and their labor unions. It's headed up by an interim steering committee made up of Larry Spivak of the Illinois Labor History Society, Ron Verzoo at the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, and Ken Germanson at the Wisconsin Labor History Society. Looking to history to build a stronger future for workers, the collaborative says that unions in both nations share similarities and differences, and each can learn from the other. And on Labor History in 2.
The year was 1934. That was the day that labor organizer Frank Norman disappeared from the Lakeland, Florida area and was never heard from again. It's believed he was kidnapped and murdered by members of the Ku Klux Klan.
I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. Here's the show. No treasure laid up, family and friends. It's pull up stakes now, or pull up stakes later. For labor and man, the road never ends. Yes, the boom's gone to bust, and we're down on the doughboys. For labor and man, the road.
Our first speaker will be Dr. Alvin Finkel. Alvin is a well-known Canadian historian and co-author of a major survey history of Canada used in Canadian universities. His research focuses on labor history and the history of social policy, with an increasing emphasis over time on comparing the Canadian experience with that of other countries, including the United States. He is professor emeritus of history at Athabasca University and is the president of the Alberta Labor History Institute. As part of his work for the Institute, he was principal author and editor of the book, Working People in Alberta, A History. Dr. Finkel's latest book is Compassion, A Global History of Social Policy. Our other speaker, whom many of you on this Zoom probably know of.
So the topic I was given was how labor can change North American politics and historical perspective. And I'm going to start with my sound like point scoring for countries, but you'll see that's not really what's going on. So in 1939, the U.S. left Canada in the dust, both in social programs and in recognition of trade union rights. Surprise to many people. The U.S. had implemented Social Security, guaranteeing most workers an income-based pension. Canada had a mean-spirited, means-tested pension, and in fact, two provinces until the late 1950s still had poorhouses. The U.S. had implemented unemployment insurance, though the segregationist South insisted on control by states. Canada would follow in 1940 with a national program, but it was also restricted. The U.S. had the National Aid to Dependent Children program for needy mothers. Canada had nothing like that. The U.S. employed millions in work creation programs like the Works Program Administration, had no equivalent. So the U.S. had the Wagner Act, which made both union membership and collective bargaining agreements publicly protected entities, to a degree anyway. Canada lacked an equivalent. Trade union density in 1939 in Canada was half the American figure. Now, some dismissed a New Deal progressivism in the United States as an aberration, and we have this notion of American individualism and opposition to government universal social programs. In terms of Canada, you could point to certain things that would suggest that Canada had been more radical than the US. For example, we had the 1919 Winnipeg General Strike, where that whole city was shut down, and then that spread to a degree to other cities. The US had the Seattle Generals, but compared to what was going on in Canada, that it sort of paled. However, on the other hand, if you go earlier, you see the Knights of Labor. That's had its birth in the US. The Industrial Workers of the World, that started in the US. The Socialist Party in the US before World War I was much more effective than its equivalent in Canada. So in short, potential for working class radicalism and worker-led progressive politics is in historical terms equal between the two countries. You do get claims that are different about that, because there's this notion that somehow working people in each country are prisoners of whether they were in the country that made the American Revolution, which is supposedly about individualism, or were in Canada, where you had the people who opposed that revolution. But in fact, it doesn't work that way. So during and after World War II, Canada's union density doubled, and social programs in both countries expanded. By 1960, the two countries had converged. And then by 1970, I think it's pretty fair to say that in terms of both social programs and some protection of trade union rights, not wonderful in Canada either, but the US had been left in the dust, and it's still there. And because I guess, you know, most people don't think too far back, you get these arguments that say that the Americans aren't capable of anything else. They have this individualist revolution. They have this very individualist thinking, and we're not like that in Canada. Obviously, that essentialist theory is just wrong, because you don't have a gap that in which the United States is way ahead of Canada as late as the 1950s. If this is all about whether or not you had some revolution in 1776. And anyway, to say that revolution or that the United States in its history was individualist is ridiculous. But you had slavery and segregation, that's not about individuals, it's the opposite. And then there's US military-based imperialism and the imposition of authoritarian murderous regimes tied to US multinational corporations. That's not much to do with individualism. So why worry about these cliches anyway? They matter because they influence notions on the part of trade unionists and politicians about what's possible in their country. So to the extent that American unions think, well, we've got to deal with this kind of individualist thinking of our people, they're not going to push for too much. Now, such individualist notions actually are more challenged in political and union circles in Canada, but the extent to which we are imprisoned as this trading partner of the US really restricts a lot of what goes on in this country. So how did Canada take the lead in social programs in the 60s and union density in the 70s? There's several important factors. One is that while Canada benefited from US imperialism, we didn't have a huge military industrial complex. We were just rah-rah Cold War supporters of the United States. We got lots of military contracts. The other is that although we were just as racist as the United States, we didn't have that history of slavery and a large non-white population, other than our indigenous people who unfortunately were not even part of our politics to many in the 1960s to a large degree. But ironically, I would argue the biggest reason why the United States failed to gain in social programs after World War II, whereas Canada eventually did, is the labor's reaction in the two countries to the New Deal. In the US, regarding the FDR as their champion, labor abandoned 30-party politics and dwelt within the Democratic Party. Now, without saying anything bad about FDR, he had no franchise on that party. It was had been and would continue to be a party very much influenced by corporate interests. Nonetheless, the labor people in the US, including the new CIO, figured it was better to work inside that party for progressive change than to build a new party from scratch or try and revive the Socialist Party. But in practice, so then the Republicans end up in 1947 in control of the Congress, and they pass the Taft-Hartley bill, which takes away much of what the Wagner was supposed to provide, both in terms of right to unionize and right to strike. When the Democrats got back in control, they didn't do very much about it. So over time, labor's political weakness in the US was demonstrated by states implementing right to work legislation. The result of which, in 1954, union density in the United States was 34.8%. In 2020, 10.8, a huge fall. Similarly, regarding medical care, you had the Harry Truman's Universal Medical Insurance Bill in 1945. Labor was not able to get the political will within the US to get that passed. And in fact, by the mid-50s, then a lot of the labor unions seem to think, oh, we don't even want that, because what a great advertisement for getting people into unions is that this is the way you'll get medical coverage. They did support Medicaid and Medicare, but look at Medicaid. It's essentially a third-class kind of medical care, and it's mostly racialized Americans who are the clientele. So the trade union retreat, unfortunately, from the fight for single-payer medical care in the U.S., has occurred at the expense of the poorest and disproportionately racialized Americans. Similarly, in terms of foreign policy, instead of putting together their own, the trade union movement in the Cold War was, some people talk about it as the AFL-CIA. They simply looked at the world in the same way that their government and their capitalists did, and worked, in fact, with the CIA to suppress union movements in third world countries that were regarded as too left-wing by the corporate interests. So there are similarities for Canada, but there's also big differences. Canadian progressives, fortunately in the end, had no New Deal. As I mentioned at the beginning, we were living with great individualism, it seemed, in terms of our politics. And so in 1932, the various little socialist and labor parties strung across this country formed something called the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, a third party. And didn't do that well in the beginning federally, but it became the official opposition in three of our then nine provinces, almost off the bat. And then during the war, our trade union movement started to take off during the Second World War, and the CIO unions in Canada were very important. And they looked around, there was no way of pretending that either the Liberal or Conservative parties were worth trying to influence. So they supported the CCF. The CCF almost formed the provincial government in Ontario in 1943 and did form the provincial government in Saskatchewan in 1944. Premier Tommy Douglas and his successor made Saskatchewan the first North American jurisdiction to introduce universal prepaid hospitalization insurance. That was in 1947, and then physician insurance in 1962. Federal programs followed in 1957 and 1968, respectively. Federally, during the war, the CCF had topped the polls for a while, but Cold War hysteria took care of that. Anyway, though, the labor movement in Canada continued to not be happy with either the Liberals or Conservatives. And the Canadian Labor Congress, formed in 1956, which was the Canadian counterpart of the AFL-CIO, could make a distinction between one-party rule, like in the Soviet Union, which they didn't like, and socialism, both in terms of social policy and social ownership, which they thought in many cases was an okay idea, wasn't something that you would always oppose. And so they saw the CCF flagging, and they formed the New Democratic Party in 1961. That party, from 1963 to 1968, held the balance of power in minority federal parliaments. And it was a party that structurally was very much run or not totally run, but had a big influence by the labor movement. The NDP's price for supporting the Liberals was that they implement yet undelivered social policies, because during the war, the Liberals and Conservatives promised to do all the things that the PF was going to do, but they said, we'll do it without having to nationalize any business. So anyway, we got universal, publicly funded and operated medical insurance, guaranteeing compensation, enhanced UI that covered virtually all workers, federal payment of half of provincial social assistance costs, in return for guarantees that need alone become the basis for social assistance, and expanded social housing. I'm not claiming Canada became any kind of a paradise, or even say compared to Scandinavia, all that great. But compared to the US, we looked pretty good. So the Liberals, much like the Democrats, were a party with a huge business faction. But during the times when the NDP were had the ability to force the government out of power and force a new election, the Liberals, for two reasons, came to the table with them. One, because they didn't want to be thrown out of power, they didn't want to have to go to an election. And two, when they did go to an election, they didn't want more voters going over the NDP. They'd lost enough. So on Medicare for All, Labor played another important role in Canada. The Conservative government that was in power in the late 50s, early 60s, established the Commission on Healthcare in 1962, appointing reliable Tories. They wanted something that looks like Obamacare, actually. But and part of the argument that was made for why we didn't need a government program, except for the poorest Canadians, was you had all these trade unionists, and they all have medical care programs. The CLC and all of the different parts of the movement were there every time this commission was meeting, and they argued, look, the programs we have are bullshit. They cost a fortune to run, that comes out of our wages, and there's co-pays, exclusions. We'd be much better off with something like a national health service in Britain. And meanwhile, the social workers argued that they want to have this kind of program similar to Medicaid for the bottom 15% of income earners. You know what? The people we deal with, they won't, if it's charity, they're not going to go. They don't go to doctors now, even though many doctors will treat them without paying. And they don't go to hospitals, they're ashamed. So either you give us this full Medicare, or you could be sure that the poor are going to continue not to get medical care. And ironically, it was a report of a completely conservative commission. It would never happen today. But in 1964, that commission called for something like the National Health Service. And at that point, you had a Liberal government dependent on the NDP. So there was no turning back. However, the Liberals were very smart. They said, oh, the report does talk about how it can be introduced in stages. So we will add to the hospitalization insurance that we legislated in 1957, a physician insurance program and some lab tests and stuff like that. But you'll have to wait later for future stages. That's over 50 years later, and we still haven't had another stage. But nonetheless, when they were in power and the NDP, what depended on the NDP, the Liberals were, I would say on the whole, to the left of the Democratic Party in the States. However, when the NDP was almost crushed in the federal election of 1993, the elected majority Liberal government behaved much like the Clinton government, and it was anti-worker. Anyway, then on a provincial level, Labor-affiliated parties have made legislative strides in Canada. An NDP government in Manitoba in 1974 introduced the first and still only universal home care policy in Canada. A Parti Québécois government, the Parti Québécois sovereign and social democratic party, was social democratic at that time, in 1996, introduced the universal daycare program. And it was the PQ that in 1977 introduced Canada's first no-scab law. Two other provinces followed, although in one case in Ontario has been rescinded. It's easy to exaggerate trade union movement influence in Canadian politics, but the union density figures do make a point. 31.2% in 2020, that's down from its maximum of 39 point something percent in the 1980s, but still three times higher than in the US. And the overall impact of having a strong trade union movement, relatively speaking, is clear when you look at distribution of wealth. When you look at the Gini coefficient, I won't describe it too much, but zero is if you have 100% equality of distribution. One is if one guy has all the wealth. And in Canada, that figure, it was 0.333 in 2020, 0.411 in the US, so much worse And those figures come from the CIA fact book, so they're not cooked in Canada. Also from the CIA fact book, Canadian life expectancy at birth now is 3.2 years greater than for Americans, compared to a gap of less than a year in the early 1960s. So should American labor follow their Canadian counterpart and create their own political party? That's not for a Canadian to say, obviously. But whatever your political strategy is in both countries, the labor movement everywhere needs grassroots formulation of a clear vision of a worker-friendly, socially just society. You don't leave it to the parties. You have to be doing that yourself and in a united way and in a grassroots way. Given the head start, though, that the U.S. labor had over Canada and how far behind you've become, I think it's fair to ask overnight that you get everything that Canada has. It's not a socialist country. Why can't we have the same stuff? Because that's where it should start. And then struggles over what values and social class relations will prevail in both countries are ongoing. In Canada, the widespread view that we are more community-minded than Americans ignores corporate forces that threaten our social programs and union protection. Canadians need to build greater grassroots involvement in unions and community groups to struggle for greater equality of wealth and power among citizens. In the United States, there needs to be recuperation of the movements for a more egalitarian society that marked the period before 1945 and allowed the trade union movement to expand its influence. The union movements in both countries should work together to create solidarity among themselves in their dealings with employers and their governments to achieve common understanding how to assert the needs of working people for greater economic stability and equality, greater control in their workplaces, and sustainable environments.
We'll be back with Sarah Nelson in the second half of the March 18th online forum sponsored by the U.S.-Canadian Labor History Collaborative. The Estevan Riot, also known as the Black Tuesday Riot, was a confrontation between the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and striking coal miners in nearby Bienfait, Saskatchewan, which took place in Estevan, Saskatchewan on September 29, 1931. Here's Calgary singer James Callaghan with a song about the Clash, Small Rebellion.
Well, friends, hereby hangs a tale. The year was 1931. A good job digging for the king, while there's so many on the bum. I'd done my time across in France, fought at Morrow and at Vimy. Done my service for my country, thought I'd put the guns behind me. I should have known it from the start. Peace may be signed between two nations, but for protection of your rights, my friends, it's always battle stations. And so it was the Union boys set up shop there in the coal fields, said that they would be our voice, said that they would be our shield. They said just a little march across the town and past the station, some fine strong speakers and a band, a fairly peaceful congregation. Let them know that we were strong, show them we could be united, show them we had found our voice and that we would not be frightened. I should have known it from the start. Workers marching makes them nervous. I saw no menace in our group, peaceful of heart and stout of purpose. The local peelers were forewarned. It sure as hell they were forearmed. How could we cause them any trouble? How could they be so alarmed? Armed with truncheons and with guns, they took their line across the road, their faces cast in stone. I heard the call to aim and load, saw the deadly muzzle flash, saw the people drop around me. Took a bullet to the leg, my friends, and that is how they found me. I should have known it from the start. Should have seen the trouble coming. Seen the ugly twist of fate. Turned my tail and started running. Known when push has come to shove. And it's a heavy hand that feeds you, that the job that was your life becomes the job that slowly beats you. No use for the ranting of the government men. No use for their fine print and their fountain pen. No use in me denying. The small rebellion's over, but I'm leaving here unbound. And when the dust had finally cleared, when all dissent had been put down, I packed my life into worn bags, caught the train and left the town. In this case, justice sure was blind, at least blind to human suffering. They said they'd put us in our place, and I guess they weren't bluffing. I should have known it from the start. It's not the truth that really matters. The real world tramples on such things, leaves your mental state in tatters, makes the blowing prairie dust seem like it is stationary. Makes the proudest person humble and the strongest person wary. Makes the proudest person humble and the strongest person wary.
And now over to Sarah.
Thanks so much, Alvin. That's a tough act to follow. You packed a heck of a lot in there really fast. And I feel so privileged to be here. And this is, of course, incredibly enriching for me. I can't help but listen to you and think about the experiences of 100 years ago and what I just came from yesterday. I was in Alabama with the Amazon warehouse workers who are organizing. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Sarah Nelson. I am a 25-year union flight attendant and also now the president of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, AFL-CIO, representing 50,000 flight attendants at 17 different airlines. Let me just start here because I see history repeating itself. And if we could just get through our heads what Mother Jones told us over 100 years ago as she was fighting child labor and ultimately fighting for what became the Fair Labor Standards Act with the minimum wage and overtime laws and getting rid of child labor. And she said something that we really need to take in, especially now as we have this shared experience during coronavirus. She said, the capitalists say there's no need of labor organizing, but the fact that they themselves are continually organizing shows their real beliefs. The capitalists want the most labor for the least money. The laborers want the most money for the least labor. Workers produce wealth and build the world's palaces. But they neither use the wealth nor dwell in the palaces. If you would only realize that you hold the whole solution, that you hold the solution to the whole problem in your own hands, you could settle the whole question easily. If, for instance, instead of striking in small groups, every industry in America were to hold up, the capitalists would be obliged to yield to any and all demands, for the world could simply not go on. And the truth is that the capitalists were terrified of strikes, and most of the labor law that was put into place was done so on the backs of mass strikes and workers standing up and understanding their power and organizing together. And for example, the United Mine Workers of America, where it was in Colorado, where we had in the mine camp, the 28 languages being spoken with immigrants from all over the world. And one of the reasons that the coal barons hired these workers from all over the world is they hoped that they wouldn't be able to communicate with each other. The thing is that when there's a disaster in the mine, and you're comforting your children because their father's not coming home, or your brother or your sister went into the mine to help your father actually get the coal out because it was based on what you could get out of the mine, not how much labor you put in at the day. When you're comforting your child and someone is doing the same next to you in a different language, you're really speaking the same language. That's what I just experienced in Birmingham, in Bessemer, yesterday as I was speaking with the workers who are in a warehouse where they are notified that they have to see a supervisor if they're not touching a box over a certain amount of time, and they've got more of a relationship with an app than they do with any human beings, and they're working for the richest or the second richest person, I can't keep track, in the world. It doesn't matter at this point. Billions and billions of dollars. And Jennifer Bates, one of the workers there and one of the union organizers, testified in Congress yesterday, and she said, we're the billionaires. We just don't spend it. I thought she's echoing Mother Jones there. We build the palaces, but we neither dwell in them nor use the wealth that we create. I didn't know anything about unions when I became a union flight attendant at United Airlines 25 years ago, but I drove from St. Louis to Chicago when I was working four jobs after I had gone to an expensive private school to get my liberal arts education and had planned to be a secondary high school teacher in English. And so I'm thinking of setting up my classroom and staring down student loans. And as I said, working four jobs, trying to get by. And it was a very cold day in February in St. Louis. And I was feeling quite sorry for myself at age 23 with how hard I had to work and how much I had ahead of me. And my friend who had become a flight attendant called me, and we thought it was funny. She decided that she didn't like her major her senior year and fell into this after house sitting for a family that was all United Airlines employees. And they took a worldwide vacation with her family and encouraged her to apply for the position. And so she called me from Miami Beach as I'm freezing in St. Louis and feeling very sorry for myself. She gave me a hard time about having her toes in the sand. But what came next was a description of the job that had been turned into a career by strong women who had come together to form their union in 1945 and negotiated their first contract in 1946 that included a seniority list that was the basis of all the backbone of all the fights they would have going forward to beat back discrimination in the workplace. And she described the pay, and she described the healthcare, and she described the flexibility, and she described the pension that at that time you could take at age 50 even. And I thought, I was working four jobs at 23. Actually, it was the pension that made me get in my car and drive to Chicago the next day. And when I think back on that conversation, I kept get pretty emotional because I think about those women who formed their career and beat back all these discriminatory practices, which included having to quit if you were over the age of 32, if you got married or got pregnant, you had to step on a weight scale until 1993. And they even took pity on the men and made sure that men could have the same rights as them on the job and have the right to have this career as their own too. So you're welcome, guys. We want to make sure you have equality. I think about that and I think about what they did and that they formed that conversation that I had with my dear friend that encouraged me to go apply for this job. So it was the union that brought me to United Airlines. And then when the company failed to pay me, and I couldn't get any answers in the office. And it was a fellow union member, a line flight attendant who I'd never met before, who tapped me on the shoulder in a moment when I had nothing left in my bank account. And I was getting some of the same run around in the office. She tapped me on the shoulder and she asked me how to spell my name. And she handed me a check for $800. And she said, number one, take care of yourself. And number two, you call our union. And I did call our union and I had my paycheck the very next day. But I always tell everyone that I learned everything I needed to know in that moment when she was standing in front of me. Because in our unions, we are never alone and we can do things that as individual employees, we can never do on our own. So the union called me back and asked me if I wanted to volunteer. And I was so honored. I didn't know that people said no. And so I got involved and we were organizing for a contract at the time. And so I exited my probation period and went straight out on the picket line after my probation exit interview with the supervisor and led cheers the rest of the day. And we negotiated a contract that I thought was not reflective of the value of the people that I had met. And so I became a union agitator and just a really loud voice and a strong voice for justice. And people kept egging me on to do more and more in the union. And soon I learned that actually it was these women who formed this union and wanted us to have something that was our own and shape our own careers, who had made it possible for me as a new flight attendant and agitator to get involved and actually make a difference and shape our union and start to make changes. And they had created this democratic organization that was just there for me to use and be a part of. And I thought back to my first day on the job. I had suppressed this experience that I had my first day flying as a flight attendant. I checked in the office and there were these two flight attendants who had been flying for 35 years. And so they started in the 1960s and they had lived through all the years of smoking too. One of them had a very raspy voice and they'd had a tussle in the office with the supervisor and they had argued over a provision of the contract and they won. But then they realized that as a brand new flight attendant, fresh out of company training, maybe that was a little bit much to watch that conflict take place. And one of them took me aside and she said, listen, management thinks of us as their wives or their mistresses. And in either case, they hold us in contempt. Your only place of worth is with your fellow flying partners. And if we stick together, there's nothing we can't accomplish. And it was that kind of spirit that did take on Big Tobacco and won in getting smoking out of our workplace and making flying better for consumers too in the process. And it was that kind of spirit that pushed through all of the discrimination, all of the efforts to cast us aside, made management have to meet us at the table and negotiate a pension of all things, my God, for the women, and healthcare. And we also fought then for one of the first contracts that had domestic partner benefits in it. And we then testified in the San Francisco City hearings that led to domestic partner ordinances in San Francisco and put us on the road towards marriage equality. So I think about our union and I think about the history of the Voting Rights Act and all of the social programs that were put into place. And that was on the backs of workers striking and standing up in their workplace. And in our case, we carved this out in our contract, but then we brought United Airlines to the fight too, because they didn't want to have to be the only corporation that had to provide domestic partner benefits to LGBTQ people. My God, no, They wanted others to have to be able to compete with them. So we brought that power of capital too when we negotiated at the table and pushed forward on these social justice issues. And that made a real difference. That made a political difference. So it's workers who form their unions and fight these battles in the workplaces and find common cause together, even though in many cases, we don't even speak the same language. But we understand that we have more in common than anything that can divide us when we form our unions. And the issue then is, as we form these rights and we fight for them, and we even fight bloody battles in some cases in order to get these rights, once we gain those rights and the corporations have to capitulate, after a little while, they don't want to give that up and they'll challenge that in any way that they can. And so our rights are eroded, for example, with Taft-Hartley, which led to all of the right-to-work states where we have tried to weaken unions and decrease union density. And they've done that through bankruptcies that they've used as business tools rather than actual reorganizations. And that's been about stripping away pensions and stripping away pay and changing careers forever and the market rate for that labor. And they've done that by creating contract work that had previously been employment at the corporations themselves. For example, at the airlines, the SkyCap who checks your bag out at front in the front of the airport, the people who make the plane food and stock that on the planes, that all got contracted out. And much of the groundwork got contracted out too. And that was about trying to not take responsibility for that labor and also cut those labor costs in half and get rid of union contracts. And they did that also through consolidation and mergers. And so union density has been on the decline, and so has labor law. And so has the efforts by labor organizers to say the word strike. And they have really attacked our right to strike. They've attacked our right to secondary boycotts and sympathy strikes that would allow us to fight these sorts of things where they create temporary jobs that are doing the same thing as the person right next to them, but undermining that work with less job security, less pay, less benefits. And then it makes it harder for the person who has the union job still in the union contract to go get further, because the competition in that labor market is getting pulled lower. And so while worker productivity has been on the increase and union density has been on the decline, wages have remained flat, and all that productivity by workers in all over North America has gone to the corporations. And that has made them more powerful, has made them also be able to spend more on politics and shift the laws more to their benefit and allow them to essentially buy politics and then create voter suppression laws that make it harder for people to actually have a say and erode those voting rights that were enacted really on the backs of the efforts of workers organizing together in their workplace and understanding their individual rights to be able to stand up and speak against their employer and have a say. So this is what I saw in Bessemer yesterday, is that workers are saying Amazon is disconnected from the workers, that Jeff Bezos is out there saying, we're for the $15 minimum wage. That is entirely hollow, because in Birmingham, you cannot even rent an apartment on a $15 minimum wage. He doesn't even know what's going on in his warehouse or what those people are facing. And he's bragging about something that is below market rate for the work in that area. And he doesn't even know it. So disconnected, it just connected to politics at a superficial level. So those workers are calling bullshit on this system and rising up together and with their community based on the racial justice actions that happened over the summer. And they're organizing in their workplace and they're taking on the most, arguably the most powerful corporation in the world. And I think they're going to win. But let me just back up for a second. The teachers taught us a lot in the last couple of years before coronavirus, when they had strikes all over red states. And of course, starting with the core group in Chicago, who taught us that we could still have a strike and honor a strike and engage the community and be successful. And that was the spark that lit the fire in West Virginia, that brought people together in every community, and no school administrator would even challenge the strike that was taking place. Strikes are illegal in West Virginia. But as we know, there are no illegal strikes. There are only unsuccessful ones. And when the community and the teachers were joined together, like Mother Jones taught us to do, they won. And they not only won a raise for themselves and improve the conditions and for their students, but they won a raise for all the public workers across the state. They generated so much power. And so that caused a spark across the nation for workers to say, I can actually change something. I can actually have power. And we saw a wave of strikes all over the country. And then the government shutdown came, and federal workers who had been told that if they strike, they can even go to jail, when Ronald Reagan fired all the air traffic controllers, and many of them were indicted and were fined or spent time in jail, and they all lost their jobs and their ability to work as air traffic controllers for the rest of their lives. That was hanging over federal workers' heads. And so when President Trump really initiated that government shutdown over his border wall and tried to create a situation where we believed that we were at odds with each other, the very division of a wall between us and Mexico and a divided political electorate, that there was absolutely no truth in that. And our union saw through it, because our union, after on the wave of the firing of the air traffic controllers and then the strike at TWA with Carl Icahn replacing all the flight attendants overnight and then being out for years after that, we created a strike under the Railway Labor Act called the Chaos Strike. It's create havoc around our system. And in 1993, we conducted this strike at Alaska Airlines without it being tested in the courts. And what we said was, you're not gonna know when we strike. We could strike a single flight, we could strike a whole city, we could strike the entire system. Management won't know, the media won't know, the traveling public won't know. And it was minimum risk on the flight attendants, maximum pressure on management, and we took control of the operation. And what happened was they didn't know what to do. So when we finally struck, after bookings had already dropped by 20% without even having a single person take an hour's deduction of pay, we and management sending all their managers out on the road in case we would strike at any moment. And all of a sudden their managers came back and said, flight attendants actually do have a tough job and were sympathizing with us. We were winning the strike without even striking. They called everyone back and we finally struck, and then they fired the workers illegally. And so we went to court. And when we won in court, and the court said that chaos was legal and the strikers had to be reinstated and they had to be given back pay, management called us on the phone and said, we want to settle the contract tonight. And we said, don't you want to meet? And they said, no, we want to settle it tonight. We want to settle it over fax machine. We don't want to meet with you. Every time we meet with you, something bad happens. We just want to get this over with. We had generated so much power. And so they signed a contract over fax machine that night without discussing any provision of it. And they had taken the full contract from Southwest Airlines and simply applied it to the flight attendants at Alaska Airlines. But they didn't stop to see the one provision in the Southwest contract that only applied to a couple flights a year at Southwest, but applied to 60% of the flying at Alaska. And it created a 60% raise overnight for the flight attendants. And so they came back a week later and said, we've got to talk about this. We didn't realize what we were signing. We said, we asked you. And so it stuck. We got that 60% raise overnight for the flight attendants. And during that time, though, when we kept the operation going, but we had control of it, we still had to keep flight attendants together. They still had to be ready to be called by their union at any moment. And during that time, management created an open shop, and only 10 flight attendants out of the entire bargaining unit opted out of the union. And so we still had to practice solidarity. The strike was our tactic. Solidarity was our power. And so we broke management completely. And that strike tactic has been successful ever since. And so when I saw this federal government shutdown going on, I realized that Trump was using chaos in reverse on us. He was having us believe that this was about a border wall, when really what he was trying to do was create a situation where the federal government would be dismantled right before our eyes. And even with our permission, because we were allowing this government shutdown to go on and thinking that there had to be a political solution. And if there was a catastrophe, it would accrue all the benefit to the executive branch, and he would be able to do whatever he wanted. And if government didn't work, he would be able to argue, we don't need this government. And if the air traffic controllers walked off the job, he would fire them. And he would say, we've got to privatize this now, and we've got to privatize all these different functions of government. And that was really what was going on. It wasn't about the border wall at all. It was about accruing all of the power to the corporations and trying to privatize all functions of government. Overnight, he wanted to do what the GOP had been trying to do for decades. And so we said, we've got to take control of this situation. And we said, labor has got to talk about a general strike, and the flight attendants will not work in unsafe working conditions, and we will strike. And the next morning, a few flights started to stop in the New York area because 10 air traffic controllers decided that they could no longer go on and called in sick for work. And the package that Congress had voted down the night before was suddenly voted in, the same exact package, less than 24 hours later, because we took it out of the hands of a political analysis and put it into the workplace. Start in the workplace and the politics will follow. And so that government shutdown ended not because a few flights stopped in LaGuardia, but because the GOP recognized that workers were about to get a full taste of our power and they couldn't have that. So they ended that government shutdown before we could fully realize the power that we have together. And so this is the spirit that, and what I was taught by these women who created creative tactics, because we had to fight through sexism. We had to find creative ways to get resolutions in our workplace. And this is the labor movement that we can build today. In Bessemer, this is about the fact that in that warehouse, it is 85% Black Americans who are fighting for their rights in their workplace and fighting to be heard. And the Amazon is so tone deaf to this whole thing. They don't even know that Birmingham has major rich labor history. So when I was talking to these workers yesterday, the older generation was saying, I am so proud that these young workers are finally recognizing that they have power when they stand together. And the young workers were saying, I am doing this because my older generation has told me about unions and how much it meant to them. And I just want to make my father proud. I just want to make my grandmother proud. And so they're claiming their power. And we are on the verge of being able to claim all of the things that the workers 100 years ago in Winnipeg went out on strike for: health care, for a living wage, for affordable housing, for immigration rights that treat people as human beings. And so these were all of the issues 100 years ago, but they're still the issues today. And what I hope now is that what we learn from history is that when we gain the labor rights and when we gain these advancements in social justice, because we're fighting in the workplace and changing politics in that way, that we don't lose sight of what Mother Jones also told us, which was, you will fight and win, fight and lose, but you must fight. There is no labor management peace. There never will be, because the capitalists are always organizing for that next crisis. And they see this moment as a crisis that they don't want to waste. And the coming climate crisis is the same as well. And they will push this as far as they can until the crisis is so great that we'll accept anything rather than not be able to breathe. And so we have to learn from our history. We have to learn from our mistakes. We have to open our arms wide to all workers. This movement is for everyone. There are no borders in the labor movement. There are no divisions by gender or race or who or where you worship or who you love. We have a common cause as working people. And when we understand our history and we understand the divisions that were created by the owner class only to keep us apart with racism and slavery and sexism, we will understand that we and truly take up the reality that Frederick Douglass told us 100 years ago as well. That, where did I put it? And that power concedes nothing without a demand, of course. I was quoting this all day long yesterday. And so I just want to finish up by saying that just before this call, I was defending the relief that we won, even under the Trump-McConnell regime last year, because we put forward the demand that this time, when the relief comes, it's going to be focused only on worker pay and benefits. We did that with the airlines. 80% organized in the airline industry, and management had to meet us at the table outside of the political process. And we told them, the public hates you, if you want to get any help, you're going to have to work with us and you're going to have to work on our plan. And so we got the plan that was the true workers' first plan, historic in the United States, because we used our union density and our power, and we set forward our demands and said it has to go only to the workers. You cannot furlough any of us. We're going to keep us in our jobs, connected to our healthcare, our pensions. We're going to continue to pay into Social Security and keep the safety net programs moving and continue to pay our local and city taxes so that the services can continue and we can continue to support other jobs. And we're going to cap your pay and ban stock buybacks and dividends. And so we achieved that. And we achieved that even under the worst political conditions, because we started in the workplace and the politics followed. And that is my story. And I'm happy to take questions. But I do want to just end saying, send all your love to Bessemer. Because they're fighting, we are talking about labor rights and we are going to get better labor law. And we have gotten the president of the United States to say that the cause of the United States is to encourage labor organizing, not to oppose it, but actually to encourage it. And so we've started a narrative here about workers standing up and taking power against even the most powerful people in the world. And they're doing it. And we are going to win no matter what the outcome of that election is. But I believe they're going to win. And when they win, it will be explosive. And we have to use this moment. We have to set our demands and be very clear about them and join together and understand our history so that we can chart the path for our future. Thank you.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1975. That was the day union representatives at Bunker Hill Mining Company in Kellogg, Idaho, were notified of a policy change. The lead and zinc producer had decided to exclude fertile women from working in lead-exposed environments. Women workers had to provide a doctor's note stating they were infertile, postmenopausal, or had been sterilized. Otherwise, they would be transferred to safer departments at a substantial loss in pay. 29 women took the transfer, while at least 3 opted for sterilization. During World War II, companies like Bunker Hill promised millions of women workers that they would eliminate hazards through engineering controls. In the 1970s, a new wave of women gained work in several industries that used occupational safety language to implement exclusionary policies like the one at Bunker Hill. These took the form of outright bans on hiring of women, either altogether or in many departments considered too toxic for women of childbearing years. It meant the real loss of well over 100,000 potential industrial jobs for women. Employers could have provided actual protection through better medical coverage and benefits, installation of engineering controls, or protections to include men's reproductive health. Instead, these policies served to roll back economic and civil rights of women workers, regardless of whether they were mothers or ever planned to be. The women appealed to their union, state and federal commissions, and OSHA, but faced an uphill battle. OSHA initially fined Bunker Hill for outstanding violations and its sterilization policy, but dropped the case once Ronald Reagan took office. The women eventually won wage equivalency in their new jobs, but women working in heavy industry would continue to battle such policies for more than a decade.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
In a little mining village scarcely noticed on the map, bourgeois guns were turned on workers and their life's blood there did sap. No one dreamed of such a slaughter in that town of Estevan, that armed thugs with guns and bullets would shoot men with empty hands. Estevan, Estevan, every working woman and man should hold on to the memory of the miners of Estevan.
That'll do it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app, and even better, if you like what you hear, and we hope that you do, please like it in your podcast app and pass it along. Spread the word. Solidarity. Labor History in Two is a partnership between the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show, a labor-themed radio show out of Pennsylvania. Also worth checking out. Our music today included 3 songs about the 1913 Saskatchewan coal miners' strike. Boom to Bust, and Small Rebellion by Calgary singer James Callahan, and Estevan by Cecil Boone, sung by Peter Kastner. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Paza, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.
Death. Estevan, Estevan, every working woman and man should hold on to the memory of the miners of Estevan. Estevan, Estevan, every working woman and man should hold on to the memories of the miners of Estevan. That's Estevan, and the original lyric, the writer has, then the worker's day of vengeance will be proclaimed with each breath, but let's change it to triumph, shall we? You know, what the heck, poetic license. Take care, Anne. Hope you like the song.